you a cold open type of gal or a warm open type of gal?
Have I ever heard the term cold open?
I'm not a warm open.
I don't know warm open it either. Let's look it up.
What's the definition of a cold open?
Cold open is a teaser sequence used in television and film. Practice of jumping directly into a story at the beginning before the title sequence. Oh, so I guess what we're doing isn't really cold open because there's nothing to do with what we're going to talk about.
And then she died.
So warm open doesn't exist.
That's a shame.
So I guess this is the first ever warm open.
Congratulations.
Congratulations to you too. All right, are you ready to start?
Sure.
Hi everyone, welcome back to What I'm Afraid Of. I'm Kylie.
I'm Nathan.
How's your week been?
It's been all right. We both kind of got a weird stomach bug that was floating around.
Yeah. I only got it for like one night though, so that's good.
Yeah. Had some dizzy spells here and there, but feeling much better now.
Yeah. I read a book series in like less than a week. It's the A Good Girl's Guide to Murder. It's a trilogy, and it is so good. So if you're looking for a book to read and you like murder, then that's something to go listen to or read.
Mm-hmm.
We've been watching Love is Blind.
Love that show.
Very excited. I still feel like Shayna's going to talk to Shane again.
That would be if she crashed the wedding. She would.
She totally would.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they are all very bad at communication for falling in love and proposing just based on communication.
You without seeing them.
Yeah.
Whatever.
There was like one scene during like a beach party where I was just like, everybody here is acting stupid and I'm not rooting for anybody. Everybody's the bad guy.
Yeah.
Especially Shayna.
Yeah, she...
My feelings are valid, just the way she's acting about them is not okay.
Yeah. But if it's okay, is love really blind? Guess we'll find out. And I saw them finish Game of Thrones.
Dude, Nathan has been watching so much. This is a much longer intro than normal, but people can skip through this if they want to. He's been watching a lot of Game of Thrones, and I have to put on, like, noise-canceling headphones. It's weird because I can listen to all the true crime and read all the crime, but I can't watch anything gory happen. It's just crazy. There's a crazy amount of violence.
Anyways. So, Kylie, love of my life, why are you afraid of...
Wait, let me ask you a question.
Oh, okay.
Wait.
I didn't know what I was going there.
Yeah. I asked my husband, what are my top two biggest fears in life?
I can't just put me on the spot with this.
I mean...
Keep a lot of fears. That's why we're doing this whole podcast.
But like, which... Okay, number one...
Clowns.
Clowns is my number one fear.
Yes.
Ever. Like, a true phobia.
Yes.
Maybe we'll cover that someday, but the clown case is John Wayne Gacy, and it's terrifying and disgusting, so maybe we'll cover it because clowns are my biggest fear. But what's my second biggest fear? Birds.
Who do they work for?
Kabujawani. I feel like you figured out the bird thing very quickly in our relationship. Even before we started dating, you knew I was afraid of birds.
You made it very clear that that was one of your fears.
I've been afraid of birds for a very long time. It's because of this case is one reason. But it's a big fear, so there's a lot of reasons. I watched Birds by Alfred Hitchcock in, like, middle school. I've been attacked by a hummingbird. I've been attacked by a peacock. I was attacked by an ostrich.
An ostrich at my preschool.
You had an ostrich at your preschool?
Yeah, the lady that owned the preschool had one in her yard. It's pretty cool.
Like, in her yard?
It was one of those preschools where it's at the person's house.
Oh.
And
it was battle?
Yeah, outside that's in a little fence. So for some, like, breaks, we'd go feed the ostrich and stuff.
Dang. Well, I'm sure that was fun. But I am terrified of birds. So, the case we're going to cover today that is part of the reason I'm afraid of birds is Kathleen Peterson. This is the case from Durham, North Carolina. We live near Raleigh, so very close to home. And Nathan, you've heard of this case before.
Yeah, it's the Netflix documentary that we watched
Yes, the documentary called The Staircase.
Yes. We watched it maybe a year ago, maybe a little longer. It's been a while.
We lived here for 2 years, right, North Carolina?
Yeah, and that's the last bit of information that I remember is watching that documentary. Other than that, I don't really remember anything extra that I read. All I know is that it was a husband and wife, and she wasn't around, and she died. And there was no real good alibi for the husband. That's at least the story that I remember.
Okay.
So I really don't remember this at all.
Okay, good. That helps. So.
Maybe as you tell the story, I will remember more.
It'll come back to you. Because you had strong opinions afterwards. We'll see if you have the same opinions.
I will comment as we talk.
Perfect. So my sources are the U.S. Sun, Audubon.org, My Favorite Murder Podcast, episode 139, NBC News, Wikipedia, Bot Catalog, Statement Analysis Blog, NBC News, and the David S. Rudolph website. So, December 9th, 2001, at 2:40 a.m., a 911 call is received from a house in Durham. The man on the other end said that his wife had an accident, she fell down the stairs, but that she's still breathing. When the cops arrive, Kathleen Peterson is found unconscious at the bottom of the staircase in their home. So, let's rewind the tapes and talk about Michael and Kathleen. Michael was born outside of Nashville. He got his bachelor's degree in political science from Duke University. He was president of his fraternity, and he was also the editor of the Daily Student Paper. So, smart guy. After graduation, he took a civilian job with the Department of Defense. And in that job, he did research to argue for more U.S. military involvement in Vietnam. So he took his political science major and went to do that job. He married a woman named Patty in 1965, and they had two sons named Clayton and Todd. In 1968, he enlisted in the Marines and served in the Vietnam War. He was honorably discharged after an injury. The family lived in Germany for a short period of time. They made family friends named Elizabeth and George, who had two children named Margaret and Martha. George died while deployed, and the families got even closer after that. And then Liz died as well, so both the parents died. And Margaret and Martha were given to Michael and Patty for guardianship.
That's crazy.
Yeah. 1987, Michael and Patty got divorced. The boys went with Patty, and the girls went with Michael. So the adopted daughters went with Michael. And after Michael and the girls moved to Durham, eventually the boys came as well. So all five of them were living together in Durham. For work at this point, he was writing novels, but he was also a columnist for the Durham Herald Sun. His columns were known for criticizing the Durham DA, defense attorney. Then he met Kathleen. They were married in 1997, and Kathleen's daughter, Caitlin, joined the already blended family. They lived in a beautiful mansion in Durham. I have some pictures of it.
I do remember the pictures.
The house is gorgeous.
Yeah, from the Netflix documentary, the video throughout the house, it looked like it was a very nice house.
It's a mansion.
Yes.
We should drive back to that. I really want to drive by sometime.
We should have done this podcast near their house.
Spooky, you be
at night.
Oh. In 1999, Michael actually ran for mayor of Durham. One of his main points about why he would be the mayor was his service in the Army. He talked about the injury that he had and the Purple Heart that he got because of the situation. From the sources, it sounded like he described the event as a fellow Marine got hit by a grenade and he got shrapnel in him and was that clearly did something heroic because he got the Purple Heart. And the shrapnel injury is why he got sent home.
Yeah.
So he came in third place in the primary.
Wow.
So, not bad. The incumbent mayor won.
Mm-hmm.
But. So that's some background on them, their history. So back to the present.
Mm-hmm.
Some sources say that the cops on the scene were confused by the blood being pretty dry when they got there. The blood around her was dry.
Was there a time frame of how long it was between the phone call and the police on scene?
No.
Okay.
But I assume pretty, not quick enough that the blood would dry. Because blood is wet and then it's tacky and then it dries.
Yeah.
Takes a while. So Michael explained to the cops that his wife was under the influence of alcohol and a muscle suppressant that night. So she must have fallen. And he didn't hear anything because he was sitting by the pool.
Mm-hmm. From what I remember, they were apart.
Yes, he was at the pool. Their pool. The pool on their property. The autopsy did show that the alcohol in her system was 0.07, and the legal limit, at least for a felon, is 0.08. So she was fairly intoxicated. It also showed that her neck cartilage was injured. The autopsy also claimed that it took her 90 to 120 minutes to die from her injuries.
Yikes.
That's a long time span.
So unless they took longer than 2 hours to arrive on scene, it's suspicious.
Just keep listening. The conclusion from that autopsy was that she died by homicide, that her death was caused by an assault with a light but firm object. A week after the death, David Rudolph and his team were hired. David Rudolph is the person that I mentioned earlier reading his website. One thing you will notice about a lot of source material if you look up this case is that it is mostly from the defense side. The documentary was as well. So a week after the murder, David Rudolph and his team were hired. Michael's brother is a lawyer. So Michael's brother reached out to his friends and they all recommended David Rudolph. So he was hired. Around that time, Michael allowed the documentary team to have a crazy amount of access to his life and legal proceedings. It's just worth mentioning that the documentary started filming very early on in the process.
Yeah, from what I remember, like, it seemed like a lot of things were being recorded that you usually don't see.
Yes, that's why it's such a good documentary.
It was very open.
It's one of the most famous true crime documentaries, I think.
That's awesome.
So Michael was very adamant that his relationship with Kathleen was a loving one, and all of the children that they interviewed shared that sentiment.
That they were in love with each other.
Mm-hmm. And Kathleen's sisters also agreed that their relationship was good. The couple's friends all say that their relationship was enviable. So nobody here is saying that they had a tumultuous relationship.
Yeah.
With his defense team, they put together a timeline of that evening. Michael says that they rented a movie from Blockbuster that was substantiated by a receipt from that night. Michael says that they watched a movie and drank wine. That was substantiated by a witness testimony of a friend who had stopped by and saw them watching a movie and drinking wine. Michael said that nothing out of the ordinary occurred after the movie. Rudolph's blog said that that was substantiated by a phone call between Kathleen and a coworker at 11 p.m. and that the coworker said that she sounded normal on that phone call. So the other ones I say, those were substantiated. This one, I'm like, okay, that was their proof.
Mm-hmm.
That's not great proof, you know? How well did the coworker know her? Yeah. Like, if I called, like, one of my coworkers right now, I would have no idea if they were acting.
Unusual
for being at home.
What did she do for work?
I don't know. She was loaded.
I can't
say she was loaded. She's a murder victim. Hold on. I don't know what she did for work. I know she made a lot more money than Michael. She was the main breadwinner.
Gotcha. I don't know what line of business she's in, but everyday people don't call their coworkers at 11 p.m.
Also a very good point. So you're right, they probably have more friends than anything else if they're calling that late. Yeah. Or she works a job of like the stock market or something where you have to be aware all the time.
Yeah. Again, I don't know what her job was. I don't know their coworkers' relationship, but
yeah,
I just find it just weird unless they were more than just coworkers.
Yeah. So leading up to the 2003 trial, the main issue that Michael's defense saw was that the prosecution was going to try and use Michael's sexual preference against him. Michael is bisexual. The defense even went as far as hiring a jury consultant before the trial to help them figure out how to navigate jury selection and the best way to avoid a prejudice against his sexuality. Do you know what a jury consultant is?
Is it someone who selects the jury?
Kind of. Okay. When you have a trial, there's jury selection before the actual trial starts where you ask the jury a bunch of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Like some big ones are you for or against the death penalty? Have you heard of this case before? just questions like that. So a jury consultant will come in and advise them on what questions to ask, what if a certain answer is given to strike them from the jury.
Interesting.
That lets both sides try to make sure the jury is as neutral as possible going into it.
Makes sense.
The defense did all of this, but they believe that this had nothing to do with the case. It just, you know, a personal thing, but the prosecution disagreed and they were going to bring it up. So,
I mean, early 2000s, people were a lot more against this.
Yes.
Now there's laws against this type of stuff.
Against?
Being bisexual and sexual preferences.
Oh, at that time? Yeah. Well, I don't know, but you might be right. So, prosecution. Their theory was that she was struck in the back of her head by her husband and that he used a blow poke that was missing from the house.
Or the fire pit.
Yes.
I remember this.
Mm-hmm. Here is the evidence that favors the prosecution. There is a footprint on Kathleen from Michael's shoe. There's evidence that the blood had been cleaned up at the scene.
Where was the footprint?
On her body.
Like, where on her body? It didn't say? It
didn't say. There was blood on the inside of Michael's pant leg. Michael was the only person home when she died. The autopsy said it took 90 to 120 minutes for her to bleed out, and they assumed that she was conscious for a good portion of that time.
So kind of painful.
So if she was screaming, why didn't he hear her? He said he was out by the pool for hours, but he was wearing shorts and a t-shirt, and it was December.
I mean, it's North Carolina. It does get below freezing here.
Mm-hmm. But it could also be 70 degrees in December, so.
Depends on the day.
Yeah. They just kept saying if he had popped in for a jacket or a blanket, he would have found her. This argument I'm not so sure of, and I will pull up. I put this Google Maps link in here. I just want to show you where the pool is in relation to the house.
Okay.
So, that's the pool, and this is the house, and from what I've seen, the staircase is in here.
It's a good distance away.
Huge distance. And in some sources, it said, like, the pool was running. You know how pools can be loud?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't not believe that he couldn't hear her if she screamed.
Yeah. And obviously, if she's injured, how well can she scream? Because it was... Something towards her neck.
Mm-hmm. She could be conscious, but still not able to.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point. Some more evidence that the prosecution felt was in their favor was that the couple was $143,000 in credit card debt.
I thought they were loaded.
Yeah, I did too. Well, Kathleen makes a lot of money, but we know that people can make a lot of money and still spend it poorly. Michael was not making a lot of money from his writing, and Kathleen suspected that she was going to be laid off pretty soon from her job. And she had a life insurance policy of $1.4 million.
That tends to happen.
Mm-hmm. There were also batch deletions of files from Michael's computer that happened both before and after her death. So just a lot had been taken off his computer.
Weird.
But we don't know what it was, so I don't know if that's evidence on it.
Could be just a coincidence.
Yeah. Some believe his 911 call could be suspicious. So I'm going to read you some things about that from a statement analysis blog that might look into things a little bit too hard, but it's also what they do. So when he called and they said 911, where's your emergency? He paused before his address, which he shouldn't have needed to. He should know his own address very quickly.
He's been living there for a while.
Mm-hmm. They say that this shows that he didn't want the crime to be linked to his home. Or was he hesitating about what his emergency was?
That's clever.
He says that she had an accident, which immediately distances him from the situation.
I had an accident.
Well, he says she had an accident, saying I had nothing to do with it. It was an accident.
Just an accident.
Whereas, I guess the normal thing to me is something happened.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Hey, something happened. My wife died. Or, hey, she had an accident. It's her fault. I had nothing to do with this. I do see the difference there.
Yeah. He also said that she is still breathing. And the still implies that he expects her to stop.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. Saying she is still breathing also jumped to a question they hadn't asked yet. They didn't ask if she was breathing. they said, is she conscious? And he said something like, no, she's not conscious. She's
still breathing.
She's still breathing.
Oversharing information.
Yeah. This leads people to think that he waited to call 911, assuming that she would stop breathing, so that he wouldn't call until she was dead, so there's no chance of reviving her.
Yeah.
90 to 120 minutes. And he's like, I'm in too deep now. I got a call now. They also ask him how many stairs she fell down, and it takes him a minute to say. It takes him quite a while to say how many stairs. People say he could either just be in shock, or he wasn't even near her when he was on the phone.
Yeah, there's always...
And he wasn't near her.
There's always that saying that you never know how you're going to react until you're in the situation.
That's the thing.
And it's tough, especially with 911 calls, because I've called 911 once in my entire life.
Really? Oh, at the motorcycle accident? With your dad?
I wasn't there. But it was with my dad, and this guy, like, we were driving down by our road. You know that big intersection with the barn right here?
Yes.
We were driving down that big intersection. I think I was coming home from basketball practice. And this, like, minivan in front of us, this guy was, like, out of the car. Like, the sliding door on the right-hand side, he was outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were slowing down to a stop, and they were going, like, 20, 15 miles an hour. And he just jumps and, like, rolls onto the grass, like,
yeah,
a good distance.
Why?
And so my dad stops behind him and is like, hey, dial 911 and tell him we're at this intersection and that, just explain what happened. So I did, and I was like, hey, we're at the intersection between here and here, and this guy just jumped out of the car. We're kind of, like, approaching him. We don't know what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, my dad had his suspicions about what was going on. But the police arrived, and we kind of talked to him for a couple seconds. But the guy, like, got back in the car and, like, drove off really fast. So we, like...
In the car that he jumped out of?
Yeah, because they pulled over as well.
What on earth? That's so scary.
Yeah, super weird.
Did the cops find him? Was he kidnapped?
We gave the license plate to them, and I didn't hear anything else.
What did your dad think happened?
He thinks that the guy was on some type of drugs, or he was trying not to get caught, or an argument, stuff like that. But that's the only time I've dialed 911. And it was intimidating. Like,
yeah.
That's my point bringing this up, is that as a kid, like, I was scared to bring this up, even though, like, I was there in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I was intimidated. I didn't remember who I was. Like, it just happened so fast, because it's something you see a lot in movies.
How old were you?
I mean, I was 15.
Yeah.
15, 16.
It's a good point.
I was young enough that I couldn't drive on my own.
Yeah.
So.
Young enough that it would be terrifying to call 911 too.
I mean, even if it happened now, like, sometimes it's like your brain doesn't fire as fast as you are when you and I are sitting down right here.
Yeah, when they talked about the question of, like, who counts the stairs?
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of lines. It'd be hard to count.
It's tough.
I think if I was calling, I'd be like, one flight. You know?
Yeah.
But again, I'm not in this situation.
It's tough. And then it just gets overanalyzed by people after the fact.
Yes.
When they're not in that situation, they're not using the adrenaline that's going through their brain at the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's the tough part. So, in his defense, I don't know how I would have reacted if you fell downstairs. I might forget my name. Like,
don't talk about it.
Things happen very
fast. Don't put us in this position. It's going to make me upset. He also takes a while to respond when asked if she's awake, and that's just the same dilemma. Is she in shock? Mm-hmm. Sorry. Is he in shock, or is he just not near her?
Yeah.
Enough to know. The conclusion that the statement analysis made is that he's lying about something, that he had information about her death that he was not sharing. Another piece of evidence that the prosecution viewed as in their favor was his bisexuality. They revealed during the trial that Michael had contacted a male escort multiple times via email. Although he had never met up with this escort, the prosecution put forth that Kathleen had discovered their emails, and that had led to the confrontation that ended in her death.
Maybe that's the information that he wiped from his computer.
Maybe. But then they wouldn't have found it. Maybe there was worse stuff.
Maybe there was worse stuff.
They also said that he would choose to kill her instead of divorcing her because life insurance policy, and it's expensive to have a divorce, and she had a lot of money.
And they were in a lot of debt.
Mm-hmm. The prosecution during the trial showed the jury Michael and the escort's sexually explicit emails and photos from the escort that he had sent Michael.
Oh, shoot.
Sexually explicit photos. According to some sources, Michael claimed that Kathleen was aware that he was seeing men on the side, but that she was okay with it.
Sure, I'm sure she was.
Sources also say that Kathleen and Michael's family and friends believe that she had accepted his bisexuality. That's different from her knowing that he was seeing men on the side.
Very different.
If he came out to her and she was accepting and understanding, great. But that's different from him revealing all this to her. And Kathleen was married before Michael, and she divorced him for cheating on her. So...
yeah, either she loved him a lot and wanted to stay with him after he said that he was bisexual and that he had these relations with a man, or that...
we don't know. Yeah. Another thing that they used to discredit Michael to prove that he was a liar was that he had made false claims about his wartime injuries and medals. The medals that he claimed to have during his mayoral run, there was no documentation found for them. Like, he had the physical medals, but there's no documentation that Michael Peterson had ever earned any of those medals.
Interesting.
Also, the injury that he claimed was from shrapnel was actually from a car accident.
In the army?
Yeah.
Well, it said in Japan, but he served in the Vietnam War.
Yeah, a lot of things aren't adding up.
Yeah, I don't know if he's driving or not. While the prosecution was arguing, they could not point to any time that the relationship between Michael and Kathleen was rocky. So how were they going to prove that he was capable of murdering her? To do that, they went back to 1985 when Michael and Patty were living in Germany. Remember that friend named Liz?
The previous wife?
Yes.
Okay.
Remember Liz? The mother of the two girls that they adopted?
Yeah.
So she died. She died of a cerebral hemorrhage. She was found by the nanny at the bottom of a staircase.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Many sources concluded that Liz had died of natural causes. Like, because they were a military family, the U.S. military, U.S. government, and German government all claimed, or all concluded, natural causes. But Michael was the last person to see her alive.
Uh-oh.
He dropped her off at the house the night before, and then the next morning, the nanny found her dead at the bottom of the staircase.
Yeah.
Scary coincidence.
That is a scary coincidence. It's almost like he knew how to set up the second crime scene.
Mm-hmm. When the defense challenged this theory, saying that there was no motive for him to kill her, the prosecution was like, well, maybe Michael was the father of one of Liz's kids. But the DNA proved that he was not.
Oh.
So they were just kind of throwing that out there to see what hit stuck to the wall.
Yeah.
The motivation couldn't have been money either, because it was actually a financial burden to the Petersons. It's rude to say a financial burden when a woman dies, but it was expensive to take care of her daughters.
Yeah.
They took in two more kids.
Two more mouths to feed, two more changes of clothes, two more everything.
Yep. Those two girls not only stayed with Michael and Patty, but Michael divorced Patty and married Kathleen, and they followed him throughout the whole thing. So they had a pretty good relationship with him.
Yeah.
Which I think is important. The defense whittles his argument down to circular reasoning, meaning that Michael killing Liz was proven by the fact that he killed Kathleen, but you prove he killed Kathleen by the fact that he killed Liz. So it just keeps circling back.
Yeah.
You know?
Very contingent on it if this actually happened.
Yeah. And the defense also argued that the only tumultuous relationship situation that Michael had been in was his divorce from Patty. And she wasn't dead.
Yeah.
So why would he kill two women that he had no quarrel with?
It's kind of a lame argument to bring up in my non-legal view.
In fact, his ex-wife Patty was in the courtroom during the trial, sitting on the side of the defense.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. From the sources, it didn't seem like the jury knew that. They didn't know that his ex-wife was in there on his side.
Mm-hmm.
Because Michael was the last person to see her alive, and because the body was found at the bottom of the staircase, that was enough evidence for them to exhume Liz's body.
Holy cow, the one that died earlier?
Yes.
And where was she laid to rest?
In America.
Okay.
On the East Coast somewhere.
Wow.
She was flown back to be buried in America.
Okay.
So 3 weeks before the trial, the body was exhumed and brought to North Carolina. Her daughters were horrified, but the council advised them not to object because it would make it look like Michael had something to hide.
It's just disrespectful for a body to be exhumed, in my view.
Especially with so little evidence.
So little evidence, so little motive. Mm-hmm. Like, he really didn't have any motive to kill her, in my opinion so far.
And if the family doesn't want it to happen, but you put them in a catch-22.
That sucks. So, body's exhumed in North Carolina now. What did they find?
Well, first, the defense was going to file a motion for that not to be admissible. Anything from Germany to be admissible. Because it's like a second trial within a trial. But before the court could rule on that, the press was all over it.
Oh, boy.
Even if the jury was told to ignore whatever happened, they can't unlearn it.
Yeah, that really sucks.
Yeah, apparently, like, news vehicles were following the vehicle that was taking her body back to North Carolina.
Man.
The autopsy result was that there were small cuts on her scalp and the inflicted and the autopsy result from this new autopsy from the North Carolina autopsy technician was that there were small cuts on her scalp and, quote, the inflicted trauma is clearly from a homicidal assault, end quote.
Dang. So something big.
It said small cuts, but it said trauma, so. The defense moved to seal that report until the judge had ruled on whether that evidence was admissible, but they were denied. So the media covered that Liz had died of homicide.
Oh my gosh, that's insane.
The defense felt that the jury pool had been poisoned.
Yeah, I'd feel that same way.
Yep. During the trial, three women testified that there was a lot of blood at the scene of Liz's death. The defense thinks that their stories were too rehearsed, almost word to word, word for word.
Like they'd been coached.
Yes. Plus, it was 18 years after the fact. And reports from when it happened said there was zero blood. But 18 years later, these three women are all of a sudden saying there's a ton of blood there.
Convenient.
When we were watching the documentary, I was shocked that they let that evidence into trial.
Yeah.
It's your second trial. We are trying him for one thing. We can't try him for two things.
But that circular reasoning, if they can pin him on this first trial,
then he almost definitely killed Kathleen.
Exactly.
Yep. The prosecution had two killer witnesses that they brought in. Dwayne Deaver was one. He's a blood spatter.
Splatter?
Yeah. Blood spatter expert. According to him, the blood
say with an L.
Blood splatter images showed, okay, just hold on. According to the defense, the images of the blood splatter showed change after Michael was removed from the scene. So the pictures taken right when they got there of the blood and the pictures taken later were different, according to the defense. They used this point to argue that the crime scene was not even properly preserved. And if it was not preserved, then the opinion of a blood splatter expert would mean nothing.
Yeah.
But he still testified. He did experiments to show how the blood splatter was evidence of a murder, but the defense felt that he was making it up all along. Basically, Michael's pants had a small amount of blood on it, and the defense said, oh, that's just because he was holding her and putting towels on her head. And Deaver proved in his experience that the blood could have resulted from him standing over Kathleen and beating her one more time.
So when you're saying inside of the pants, are you saying like on the inside of the pants, like?
Like the inside leg.
Okay.
Not like on the upper.
On the outside of the pants.
On the end. Yeah. I think so. Let's look it up. I always imagine on the outside of the pants, but just like.
Because when you say inside of the pants, I imagine when you when you turn the pants inside out that you saw the blood.
That not how I pictured it, but it does sound reasonable from what I've said.
If inside of the pants just means...
It looks like it's on the outside of the pants,
but
it's on the inner leg. Like
inner leg crotch area.
Yes, that's what it looks like. It looks like he's wearing shorts.
Yeah.
From these pictures. I'll put this picture on the Instagram too, so people can see it. It also just looks like those pants are dirty.
They're his sit by the pool at night shorts, I guess.
True. The other killer witness was a medical examiner named Deborah Radish. Basically, she was just the person who did the autopsy.
Gotcha.
She was just testifying for it. The defense argued that the fact that Kathleen had no skull fracture or brain injury meant that the conclusion of blunt force trauma was fake. Like, just could not happen.
All right.
So, on to the defense. When the prosecution said they had no more evidence to share, the defense wasn't even sure if they wanted to talk. They didn't even know if they wanted to share evidence. They felt they had already discredited the prosecution so much that the jury could not go on without reasonable doubt. Watching the documentary, I fully agree. I feel like they put so much reasonable doubt in there. There was nothing solid.
Yeah, because that's all the defense needs to prove is reasonable doubt.
Yeah, that we're not 100% sure that he did it.
And from the prosecution side, they didn't do a great job prosecuting.
I don't think so either. They called three experts, none of who definitively rule out that the injuries to Kathleen's head were caused by an attack, but they do say that the injuries were more consistent with a fall. So they had to be honest. They couldn't 100% say it wasn't caused by an attack, but they said it was much more consistent with the fall downstairs.
So they're almost proving the defense's point.
This is the defense witness.
Oh.
We're on to the defense's arguments now. So basically, being hit with a blunt force instrument was not the only possible cause of Kathleen's injuries. Their blood splatter expert said that the blood was consistent with a fall on a staircase. He said that it may have looked like a lot of blood, like in pictures or to people, but she had been there for a long time. It could be her coughing up blood rather than actually coming from her head, and the blood could be mixed with urine from when you die, and that makes it just look like the volume is more, but it's not all blood.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. The defense also chose not to have Michael testify because he would be cross-examined about his sex life and any lie that he has ever told. And that would get him riled up, and then the trial would quickly come down to, does the jury like him or not?
And that's not very fair.
Yeah, they did not want to risk that.
You cannot like somebody, but they can still not be a murderer.
Exactly. Liz's daughters were willing to be called as character witnesses for Michael, but the defense decided not to call them either for the same reasons. They didn't want them to be harassed about their own mother's death.
Which makes
a lot of sense. And about the sex life of their adopted father.
Which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. They did choose to bring the jurors to the Petersons' house. This is a debatable choice because the staircase did not cooperate Deaver's theory, but going there brought up a lot of negative feelings.
Is that a normal thing for a jury to take a field trip?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I didn't know that.
This is the bottom of the staircase.
It's a very scary picture.
Yeah, it's like a steep staircase. There's like a good amount of flood, but... there's another one.
Yeah, that...
like, imagine seeing that person.
I'm assuming it would be a lot worse in person.
Mm-hmm.
There's some other from angles, like, you can see it on the wall.
Yeah, it's like, it's the water's, like, up.
Like...
which is kind of weird for a fall. You know what I mean?
It must have been really head first and landing so that you, like, spit up blood or it, like... I don't even know. It's
mm-hmm.
It's really, I'm not a blood splatter expert, but for it to like hit the ground and then go up is like, kind of like when you drop like a water balloon and it goes out.
And that's kind of drawing
what it's looking like.
There's also a lot of armchair detectives on the internet who post different like graphs and diagrams, but like it looks bad. So, clearly being there would be traumatizing and make them want to do something to make it okay.
Yeah, so. That's probably the reason they bring them out there.
So, in the midst of the trial, remember that murder weapon?
The pokey fire thing.
Mm-hmm. The blowpoke?
The blowpoke.
Weeks into the trial, They found it. Michael found it in his garage.
Michael found it.
Mm-hmm.
Convenient.
The defense didn't want it to look like they'd staged the discovery. But it not actually being missing completely ruins the prosecution's case.
Yeah.
So, again, like you said,
there's no smoking gun.
It's very convenient. But from the defense's point of view, they just found this. And they don't want it to look staged. But they have to bring it up because it's the murder weapon. If they don't have a murder weapon, yes, it's the murder weapon that they were like, this is what happened, this is what he did, that's what they used to do the experiments. Like, they were really gung-ho on this.
Yeah.
They also didn't know if they could disclose the blowpoke information because of attorney-client privilege. Because Michael told them about it.
Yeah. They just bored one day going through something. Wasn't it the garage?
It was in the garage.
Yeah, I'm remembering that.
So they called the judge and asked, there's a fancy word for it, but basically they asked to meet with him without the prosecution knowing that they were meeting with them. And he confirmed their ethical decision that, like, you're right, that you gotta really figure out how to bring this to light without breaking client attorney privilege. So the blowpoke was photographed because there was a ton of, like, cobwebs on it.
And those don't just happen in a matter of months or weeks. Well, months, maybe.
Well, it doesn't happen if he just put it there. It'd be like, oh, okay.
Here it is. I see your point.
Yeah. And it was preserved. They had a forensic expert test the blowpoke for damage or blood, indicating that it was a murder weapon. No evidence. Nothing to show that it was a murder weapon. So eventually they were able to present it in trial. They used photos of its discovery, showing the cobwebs on it to show that it had been there for some time. So, with that, the defense rests. He was found guilty.
Really?
I was shocked. At that point in the documentary, I was very on the fence of if he did it or not, because things don't line up on both sides, you know? But there's more than enough reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
More than enough.
Like the jury didn't understand the purpose of them being a jury with beyond reasonable doubt, that they have to know for sure that he did this.
Yeah.
And that's a big sentence to carry out, that you're guilty of killing somebody. But I like what you said, where them going on a field trip to the murder scene, mm-hmm. supposedly the murder scene.
Yeah, the scene of her death. Crime scene.
The crime scene. I do like what you said about how them being there brought up some type of emotion that there needs to be justice.
Mm-hmm.
And that could have been good reason for the jury to just all agree, like, yeah,
you have to do something about this,
whether or not it's the right thing.
Yes, I agree.
And obviously I wasn't in the jury. I don't know what conversations they had behind those closed doors, but to me that makes a lot of sense that, hey, we have to do something to get some justice for this poor lady, because this is her blood on the floor we're seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of blood.
She had 5 kids.
Yeah. It's tough. Really, really, really tough.
Reporters in the room reported that they were shocked by the verdict, as was I.
Yeah.
And in 2004, the Staircase documentary comes out.
Like the next year.
Yep. It was pretty quick. He got life in prison, I believe.
Wow.
He got... I don't know. 2009-2010, it was revealed that Deaver had a history of lying for the prosecution.
Remind me who Deaver is?
Blood splatter expert.
Oh my gosh. And that's, what, like almost 5 years he's been in prison?
Mm-hmm.
That's tough.
Yeah.
So what happened?
Well, he had been in prison for almost 7 years.
Well, he said 2003.
2010.
Oh, I thought it was 2009.
2010. Neither of those are 5, though.
I heard 4 from the documentary.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm an idiot. I didn't graduate college.
Okay. In 2011, Michael's defense asked for a hearing about getting him a new trial. They filed for a new trial because of Deaver's false witness. They were granted a hearing to decide if the conviction could be overturned.
Good.
They used footage from the documentary.
Convenient.
I know. Deaver's testimony in the original trial about the blood spatter being a result of a second beating was the reason that he was charged with premeditated first-degree murder. Because if it was a crime of passion, he'd push it downstairs at the lesser charge than if he premeditated it.
Yeah.
If it's premeditated, you follow her down the stairs and hit her again.
Yeah.
That shows, like,
malicious.
He was shocked. He was in shock. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that just happened. He wanted to do it.
Yeah.
So that was a big hinging point. In the first trial, and the clips that they show from the first trial, they show that they had already proven that the foundation of Deaver's entire opinion was the experiment that he did. The experiments are why Deaver said the conclusions that he did. So, as they were looking to overturn the conviction, actual blood splatter experts reviewed the experiments and determined that they were not accurate and not accepted in the field of blood splatter.
So it got peer reviewed a couple times and they're like, this guy clearly had motive.
He had no idea what he was doing.
Yeah.
The defense also revealed that Deaver had done similar false experiments in previous trials, not just Michael's.
Really?
He's seen in one video for a different trial, trying an experiment with blood splatter multiple times. And then when he finally got the results he wanted, he said, that's a wrap.
Oh my gosh.
And in the videos of him doing the experiment on Michael's case, he does it multiple times, and when he gets the result he wants, he does a victory dance.
That's really, really weird.
I wanted to find the videos, but I couldn't, but sources say that he did a victory dance at the end of it. He also claimed, when they were asking him, like, what his qualifications were, that he had done hundreds of blood splatter analysis for crime scenes, and that he had done at least 15 supposed false scenes. Actually, he had done none.
Really? My jaw's on the floor. I'm remembering this a little bit.
So, clearly, the judge ruled that Michael could have a new trial.
Man. I mean, babe, I've watched a lot of Game of Thrones lately. I could be a judge in different crimes.
Yeah.
I don't know a good analogy. I've watched a lot of basketball in my life. I could be an NBA ref.
Yeah. I've watched a lot of CSI. I know what blood splatter does.
Jeez.
So in 2014, as they were leading up to figuring out what to do next.
2014 now?
Yeah.
That's a long time.
He was out.
Oh.
He was on house arrest.
When did he get out again?
2011. He was still, like, under house arrest. So he couldn't leave his house, but he was able to, like, live at his house with his family.
Good. Not ideal, but better than being in prison.
In 2014, Rudolph left the defense team. He had moved to Charlotte, he had had a daughter, and he felt that he was too emotionally spent to go through another trial. Like, it had overtaken his entire life.
Yeah.
So he offered to help as a consult to the new lawyer, who is Clink. His actual full last name is longer, but first name is Tom Clink, because that's what he's referred to in the sources.
Like the sound Clink?
Yep. The Durham DA was not willing to close the case without a guilty plea, but they were also making no movement towards a trial. So he's on house arrest and they're not making any effort to have a new trial. When the court moved to a new building, so like the court got a new building and they moved all their stuff, some of the evidence for the trial was not properly preserved. So Clink filed a motion to just dismiss the case. Because there was none. The evidence was tampered with. Before the hearing, Clink had a stroke.
Oh my god.
And his second chair took over.
Poor guy.
The judge did not allow the case to be dismissed because he did not think that the jury's decision was based mostly on the DNA evidence, which was tampered with.
Yeah.
Because as far as I can see, the DNA evidence was that Kathleen and Michael were there at their house. So
there wasn't a lot of physical DNA evidence.
Yeah, not really. At that point, Michael called Rudolph again and asked him to help him negotiate a way to not plead guilty and not go back into custody. So Rudolph agreed to come help again. His first step was getting the new trial judge to rule evidence from Michael's computer inadmissible. That evidence was regarding his sexuality.
Yeah.
The evidence, as we know, was allowed in the first trial, but the appellate court that was dealing with all of this redoing stated that the motion to dismiss that evidence should have been granted. So the new judge granted it. So they can't talk about his bisexuality in the new trial. At a meeting with the judge, prosecution, and the defense, the judge informed the prosecution that not only was the computer evidence going to be inadmissible, but that he was seriously considering throwing out the evidence about Liz's death in Germany.
Good.
After this was revealed, the prosecution reached out to Michael's legal team and offered him an Alford plea.
Alford plea?
Do you know what an Alford plea is?
I'm sure I heard it on the documentary, but remind me.
An Alford plea is that you're not saying you're guilty, but you're saying that you can see how they would convict you, so you're accepting a guilty plea.
So it's like, I can see why you would be mad when I said this thing.
So he took an Alford plea for also the reduced charge of manslaughter. So he was freed with time served.
Wow.
So his new sentence would be 86 months, but at that point he had already served for 98 and a half months. So he was freed.
That must be a crazy relief for him.
Yep.
I'm still very conflicted whether or not he did it. The only motive I can see for him killing his wife was the insurance policy, because they were in debt. Other than that, there hasn't been much evidence showing that he had a bad relationship with her, that their marriage was failing, because you could be bisexual instead of a happy marriage.
Yeah.
Obviously, I
don't know. The cheating's not great.
That is not great at all.
I have more information.
Okay, up until now, I'm just conflicted on whether or not he did it or not.
Here are some things that came out after the Alford plea was offered. This stuff came out because North Carolina had a change in the laws around discovery and a trial. Discovery is like the evidence, and like what you have to show. So the autopsy result for Kathleen's death was originally blood loss, but the medical examiner's boss pressured her into changing the cause of death from blood loss to blood force trauma. It was like scribbled out or something.
Really?
Yeah. The same medical examiner had reached out to Kathleen's sister, who changed her story about their relationship. Originally said that there was nothing wrong, and then later said it was tumultuous. The ME reached out to that sister and explained to her why Michael was guilty. And then she changed her story.
Uh-oh.
There's like a communication where Kathleen's sister said something back to the medical examiner. It's like, thank you for explaining to me why Michael is guilty. And then she was against Michael.
Really?
Which is just not okay.
Whoa.
Not how that works.
Why wasn't this information in the original thing?
Now wait for this. The missing blowpoke from the first trial was actually seen by investigators when they first got there in its correct place, photographed, and just simply not returned to where they took it from. They just threw it in the garage. There were witnesses to this happening.
Oh my gosh.
At the time, it wasn't a big deal because it was an insignificant part of their house. There's no blood, no damage, had nothing to do with the crime, so they just didn't pay much attention to it, and they just put it in the garage instead of carrying it back into the house. Obviously, it becomes a big deal.
Yeah.
The prosecution decides to present it as the actual murder weapon.
So where did they find it to put it into the garage?
I'm guessing by the fireplace. There's like a little stand.
I'm confused.
So when they went into the house and they were taking evidence, they saw a glow poke for the fireplace.
Near the fireplace?
Yeah. They picked it up and they took it outside and took pictures of it, but they were like, okay, there's no blood or damage on it. It's got nothing to do with anything.
Why'd they take it up and... I just don't understand why they would pick something up by the fireplace, move it, and then put it somewhere else.
Me neither.
That's really weird.
Yep. To this day, Rudolph still believes that Michael had nothing to do with his wife's death. Now, if we're getting to the end of this episode, is there a question that you have?
Is he guilty?
No. A question about the point of this episode.
Oh, what are you so afraid of?
Birds.
How do birds fit into this? You talked about it at the beginning of the episode.
Now we will get into the owl theory.
Who?
This theory arose from the issue...
Didn't even react to that. That's such a funny joke. You better not get that.
What'd you say?
Say the name of the theory again.
The owl theory.
Who?
This theory arose from the issue of what caused Kathleen's scalp injuries. Her death was not caused from the fall. It was blood loss. So what killed her was the wounds, right?
Yeah. From the blow poke. What?
Allegedly.
From the blow poke.
There were three slit-like cuts on the back of Kathleen's head. The owl theory says that Kathleen went outside. Some sources say that there were some animals outside that she would go out to take pictures of, so she was going out to do that, and she was attacked by a barred owl.
Wow.
Michael was out of earshot by the pool. She went to go upstairs. Some sources said that they had a phone upstairs, like they had to go up the stairs to call 911.
Mm-hmm.
She was going up the stairs, losing blood. She was on a muscle relaxant, and she was kind of tipsy, and she fell.
Like she was walking up, and then she fell backwards?
Mm-hmm. According to Rudolph's website, here is some more circumstantial evidence that lends credence to this theory. Barred owls were living in the woods by the Petersons' house. They are aggressive and dangerous. In December, they are having their mating season, and they are highly territorial.
Yeah.
In 2014, an article from the Journal of Experimental Biology said, quote, if a 175-pound human were struck with the same intensity from an owl attacking, it would feel like being hit by a 13-ton truck.
13-ton truck? Holy cow.
I know. Barred owls also have attacked people on numerous occasions, and they always go for the head.
Wow.
The shape of their wings, the feathers on the wings, makes them silent as they dive bomb.
That's crazy.
I know.
Good killers.
More evidence, there were drops of blood on the outside walkway leading from the front door into the house. How on earth would there be blood out there if she fell? Even if the prosecution theory is true, why is there blood outside?
Yeah, and not in the direction that he claimed he was by the pool, right?
I don't know. I couldn't find, a blueprint of the house.
Who freaking did this investigation in the first place? Like, they totally botched the crime scene. That's my whole thing.
Yeah, it's not great.
They did not do a great job. Because if they found blood, why wasn't that brought up in the original trial?
There's also a court in police photos. There's a large smear of blood on the outside of the front door. As if someone bleeding had their hand on their head and was trying to get in the door.
Again, are you sure these police officers aren't from Baltimore? Oh my goodness.
At least two of the wounds on her scalp are the shape of the talons of a barred owl. The tiny wounds on Kathleen's face are consistent with the tip of an owl's beak. And the cuts on her hands are consistent with the beak if she were putting her hands on her head to defend herself. Guess what was found on Kathleen's body?
Feathers?
A feather.
Holy cow.
Also, a twig was found and dried blood on her body.
Yeah, inside the whole time. My butt.
There were numerous strands of Kathleen's head hair with the roots indicating it had been pulled out, not cut, found in dried blood on her hands. As if something was ripping her hair out and she was trying to...
Yeah.
Kathleen's head injuries are not consistent with her having been beaten by a blunt object or by a staircase. There was no brain injury or swelling or subdural hematoma and no skull fracture.
Mm-hmm. Where, a fall would have.
Yeah, if the staircase or being hit by something was what injured her head, which doesn't make sense with the shape of it.
It doesn't.
But it would have fractured. Blunt force shot on you, but fractured something. Sharp force, something like that just scraped the skin.
And that would cause a lot of blood.
A lot of blood. You bleed a lot from your head.
Especially on a muscle relaxer and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what that combo has.
Yep. As Michael's defense team was prepping, in case they went to a second trial, they did say that there was a possibility they would bring up the owl theory.
They absolutely should.
But there was no second trial, so.
He was just home free?
Mm-hmm. So people who believe that Michael killed his wife think that Deaver and some of the misconduct of the prosecution, the police, led to a huge miscarriage of justice for a man who murdered his wife and maybe another woman. They think he was suspiciously calm and laid back during the entire ordeal. You do see that in the documentary. He's pretty calm.
He's, from what I remember in the interactions with the camcorder style film, I just remember him being very relaxed and calm and businesslike.
Charismatic almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's because he's been in war before and that he's seen dead bodies.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's seen.
or his coping.
But yeah, like I said, you don't know how you're going to react until you're in that situation.
For sure. People who think he's guilty also believe that he killed her and then waited and waited before calling 911 until she was past the point of saving. Dried blood leads them to believe that he waited, but if he didn't hear her, she was alone for a long time, then that also explains why the blood was dry. That lends credence to both theories. I don't think it's an issue.
Yeah.
It is worth noting, though, that Kathleen's daughter, Caitlin, so Kathleen's daughter that she brought into the marriage, sued him for wrongful death in civil court, and they settled for $25 million.
Holy cow.
People who now believe him to be innocent have the following arguments. Michael had a history of criticizing the Durham police, as we talked about earlier. The person he was most critical of was the DA. The DA is the one who prosecuted him.
Yeah.
Conflict of interest. The other person who helped him prosecute became DA after him, and he's the one who was disbarred and resigned for ethical violations during the Duke Lacrosse case.
Lovely.
You know the Duke Lacrosse case?
I do not.
Three Duke Lacrosse players were accused of raping a woman, but they didn't. And this DA withheld DNA test results that proved him innocent.
That's a whole other topic that we could get into.
But basically, he's an unethical person.
Yikes.
In the documentary, jurors that they interviewed later said that the reason they voted guilty was because of the blood.
Yeah, it's a lot of blood. Like I said, they probably got emotional being on site.
Mm-hmm. So, Nathan, do you think Michael Peterson killed his wife?
I'm trying to remember my initial thoughts from when we watched the documentary.
Is this thing on?
Yeah, it should be.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember my thoughts from when we were watching the original documentary, and I can't remember what I thought. But what I think now is, I think he's guilty of something, but I don't think he's guilty of murder.
Interesting. But he knows more?
I think he's probably a little guilty of his wife, like cheating on his wife.
Mm.
Or at least emotional cheating.
Mm-hmm. By messaging a lot of sex things with him.
And it's just extremely convenient.
It's convenient. The documentary, I mean.
Yeah.
But what guilty man would invite a documentary to film him? A sociopath? A narcissist?
Yeah.
I bet Ted Bundy would have.
If documentaries were a thing in Ted Bundy's time, maybe.
When we watched the documentary, you thought he didn't.
I did?
Mm-hmm. I don't think he did it. I think an owl did it. I'm afraid of them.
I can definitely, the evidence you presented to me is a lot more concrete for the owl theory than he killed her or pushed her or she fell on her own.
I will say I did present you with more evidence than you had from the documentary.
Very interesting.
So.
Maybe the documentary was supposed to make us believe that he did it.
The documentary was definitely supposed to make us believe he didn't do it.
Didn't?
Yeah. In my opinion, I thought it was very skewed.
Maybe I just believe that a lot of things were off, and that's why he did it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because the defense's theory doesn't make sense. It must have been that, but the owl theory makes sense because neither the prosecution nor the defense theory makes 100% sense.
Yeah, there's just a lot of poor information being transferred, a lot of poor information being explained clearly mm-hmm. from the crime scene being botched with pictures and evidence collected.
Yeah.
And then, because if they had bird feathers, if they had twigs, if they had the blood trail.
Yeah, on the outside of the house.
How did they miss that?
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. And that just leads me to believe that the police had it out for him because he was writing those negative things.
Yeah, that's definitely a theory.
Well, that's terrifying, and I'm glad we don't live around those owls over there. Maybe. I've never heard of them.
I haven't either until I knew it was an owl. I didn't know the specific, breed or whatever.
Who?
But yeah, that's one of the many reasons that I'm afraid of birds, because I believe that a bird killed Kathleen Peterson. and put a man in jail who was innocent.
Those birds, they'll get you.
They'll get you.
That's terrifying.
Violent and manipulative.
I can see why you're so scared of these birds.
I'm glad. I feel like this podcast is really giving you an understanding of my anxiety.
That it's a whole ripple wave effect of this man's life just being thrown under if that bird
killed. I mean, if it was an owl, then just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, not only killed his wife, put him in jail, and put half the country against him.
Yeah.
A lot of people still think he did it. I don't think he did it, but...
That just sucks either way.
Yeah. No matter what's true, a woman died. And it's awful.
Well, let us know on the Instagram page.
Yeah.
What's the handle?
Let us know if you did it. That why I'm afraid of.
Yeah, let us know your thoughts. I think hashtag Team Owl.
Hashtag Team Owl.
I think that and hashtag bad police job. Just, I can't get over that evidence thing, man. The crime scene. They just did a terrible job of presenting the crime scene, yeah. In my opinion.
Preserving it.
Preserving and presenting for the defense to present this information.
Yeah, the discovery was just not there.
Unless the police didn't tell the defense team.
Also possible.
But yeah, let us know your thoughts. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being awesome.
Subscribe to the podcast and rate it and follow us on Instagram. And we'll see you guys for the next case.
All right. Bye.
Bye.